March 23, 1967, Bolivia. In a remote area of the south, a unit of local soldiers were out on a routine patrol. They marched along the banks of the country's Ñancahuazú River. The soldiers were at ease as they gazed over the thick fauna surrounding the river. But as they watched the serene landscape, they were being watched right back. Seven of the group were killed. 14 were taken prisoner. This was the first attack in what would kickstart a Bolivian revolution perpetrated by the group known as the Ñancahuazú Guerrilla, or the ELN. The group was led by a man calling himself Adolfo Mena González, though few were fooled by the alias and recognized him immediately. After all, he had the face of a revolutionary.
Che Guevara was the perfect revolutionary icon. He was young, he was handsome, he was articulate, he wore his beret. I mean, he just looked like a revolutionary.
Who was Che Guevara? Che Guevara was a sociopathic killer in revolutionary clothes. We think of Che, we think of him in the beret with the limpid eyes, but the real Che Guevara was revolutionary, gangster, murderer.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top secret military operations.
And we are convinced that Che Guevara is in the area. And we have to move the battalion right now, we want to get him. And he understood that, he took the advice, and he ordered immediately that day the battalion to move into operations.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special operations missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
They implemented their strategy by tapping the Green Berets, who were a fairly new force of American soldiers who were focused on doing this kind of counterinsurgency.
The mission itself was this is a military unit who really doesn't have any experience in guerrilla warfare or intelligence of that type. So to advise them, at the same time, to make sure that by any chance Che Guevara was captured alive, to make sure that they keep him alive, not to shoot him, and to make sure that they became available to them.
Che Guevara had been a charismatic leader of the expanding communist revolution since the 1950s, inspiring many, as well as leaving carnage in his wake. Guevara was sure that revolution in Bolivia would be easy, but instead, it was his downfall.
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that Che made some tactical mistakes very early on. One is he picked the wrong part of the country. They're really two Bolivias.
This is the story of the last stand of Che Guevara and how the CIA and Green Berets brought his revolution to an end. This is Che Guevara's Last Revolution, Part 1. Che Guevara had been one of the key players in Fidel Castro's overthrow of the Cuban government. He then went on to play a high-ranking role in the new Cuban regime. This included the roles of president of the National Bank as well as designated diplomat. But before inspiring revolution, Che had humble beginnings in a poor leftist family in Argentina. He worked as a doctor in poverty-stricken, starving areas of South America. It was there he formed his idea to overthrow capitalism and help the oppressed. In 1955, Che's travels brought him to meet Raúl Castro and his brother, Fidel.
And what made him perfect was after he had come to power and people started to ask, who is this Che? Because he was always with Fidel, and Raúl Castro was Fidel's brother. He put himself in the spotlight by writing how-to books on revolution, how to export revolution. He was really Castro's spiritual guy.
Mitch Weiss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and co-author of Hunting Che.
He was this mysterious figure, and to a certain degree, he was a boogeyman.
To students and revolutionary youths around the world, Guevara was a hero, someone who fought for the rights of the working class and struggling individuals.
Che Guevara is really the symbol of revolution. He was young, he was handsome, he was articulate, he wore his beret. I mean, he just looked like a revolutionary. And that was the reason that there were so many poor and they weren't getting ahead. And his vision was more of a, you know, socialist communist view, which was the state takes care of you. They take care of all your needs, both education-wise, medical-wise, property-wise, so that it was more of an egalitarian approach. And that's what made him really popular among the masses or amongst college kids in the United States, that kind of idealism, that indeed we are an egalitarian society and we're going to level the playing field, so to speak.
But to the United States, Che Guevara was a terrorist, spreading communism through murder, upheaving societies, and upending capitalism.
He felt, to a certain degree, that America always backed right-wing dictators all throughout the world, and that those dictators exploited the resources and exploited the people.
John Weissman, author of a biography about the man who killed Guevara, disagreed.
Who was Che Guevara? Che Guevara was a sociopathic killer in revolutionary clothes. When we think of Che, we think of him in the beret with the limpid eyes. But the real Che Guevara was a revolutionary gangster murderer.
Che was often against the United States in particular. As a socialist, he hated capitalism. He fought against the U.S.-sponsored coup in Guatemala. Che was also an avid journalist and writer. Much of what we know about him and his movement came from his meticulously kept journals. In 1967, Che wrote,
"A people without hate cannot triumph over a brutal enemy. Our every action is a battle cry against imperialism and a battle hymn for the people's unity against the great enemy of mankind, the United States of America."
Hey folks, so we all know that guys are terrible about going to the doctor or asking for help, especially about sensitive subjects like hair loss or sexual wellness, and everybody knows we're terrible about skincare. So I really want to encourage my listeners to take a peek at 4hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness for men. These are all common problems for men of my age. Now, I'm not going to date myself, but I'll tell you that Van Halen is my favorite group, so you figure it out. Problem is, we're hardwired to ignore these things, okay? We're hardwired to try to fix them ourselves or just blow it off until it's too late. But I want you to stop doing that, okay? I want you to go to 4hims.com and take a peek at all their solutions because they're well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions that can help you do things like keep your hair. These aren't snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, man. They're actual prescriptions. You're getting connected with real doctors and medical-grade solutions, okay? Plus, there's no waiting room. You don't have to go to the doctor in person, and you can save hours just by going to 4hims.com. So do it. Knock it off, all right? Stop being such a tough guy. Log on 4hims.com, all right? My listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See website for full details and safety information. Listen, this would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy. So go to 4hims.com/covert. That's important, /covert. That's forhims.com/covert. forhims.com/covert. Go, check it out now. I'll wait. In 1967, Guevara's whereabouts had been unknown for at least 2 years. His last public appearance was 1965, where he said farewell to Cuba and went on to spark revolution around the world.
He wanted to export revolution, and more importantly, he wanted to export a Cuban-style revolution. At that point in the world, there was a Cold War, and the world was really divided between democracy and communism. And the Soviet and really Chinese style as well, but mainly the Soviet style of communism simply said that conditions have to be right for a communist takeover. Che didn't believe that. Castro didn't believe that. They believe that the conditions don't have to be right. That if you have a small group of men who are really dedicated and they start the revolution in a rural area, they can spread that revolution. They can recruit the peasants, the campesinos, and that would spread throughout the countryside and eventually make its way to the cities. And then they would take over. And more importantly, that once they did take over, that the Communist Party really wouldn't be the driving force in the government. It would be the guerrilla army that would actually run the government.
This guerrilla-style communism was known as the Cuban style, as opposed to the Soviet style, waiting for the political climate to be right for revolution. This Cuban style could be imported anywhere, as long as there was a dedicated group. Weiss says Guevara first traveled to the Congo, but after consulting with Castro, they decided to focus on South and Central America. Che started in Bolivia.
In the early 1950s, I thought that this would be the perfect spot. One, they didn't really have much of a military. Over there, you know, 150 years of, you know, independence, you know, they declared their independence in 1825. They had had dozens and dozens and dozens of coups, so it was an unstable, you know, it was an unstable government. More importantly, Bolivia borders four or five other South American nations, and from Bolivia, that could be the epicenter of a revolution that would spread from Bolivia all throughout, you know, South America and Central America. And for Che, that was really important.
For a few years, Guevara had been quietly gathering followers and fighters to follow him. And with the March attack on the Bolivian army unit, they had finally put themselves out in the open.
Well, the Bolivian government was afraid. Look at it from their point of view. They have soldiers out on a routine patrol, and all of a sudden, they're ambushed. And it didn't happen once, it happened several times.
The Bolivian government had never experienced something like this and were not prepared. So the president, René Barrientos, reached out to the United States for assistance. Mitch Weiss explained that Bolivia virtually had no army.
The campesinos and the people were expected to do a year of military service, and then after that service was up, they went home. So really, they only had about 6,500 full-time professional soldiers. Everybody else were draftees. They were conscripts.
At first, the American response was cautious. Getting involved in a foreign conflict was not exactly a top priority. The United States was currently facing backlash from the war in Vietnam, a conflict that was being seen as a massacre of Americans on foreign soil for unacceptable reasons. Weiss said that Vietnam as a public relations nightmare was something Che Guevara had taken into account.
He wanted to create 100 Vietnams for the United States so that the United States would be putting out fires. He knew that the United States was heavily involved in Vietnam, that war was escalating, and that the American public probably had no appetite to send troops all over the world. So that was his ultimate goal, was to get America engaged in a conflict in South America. And that was the way he saw bringing down, you know, America, which he believed was this imperial threat.
And the CIA was not entirely sure that Che Guevara was still alive. Intelligence had been so focused on the Cold War and the Soviet Union, they had little attention for Cuba and Che. He hadn't been seen since disappearing in the Dominican Republic in 1965, so they were even more reluctant to send in operatives. But if he was, communist revolution in Bolivia could sweep through huge countries like Brazil and Argentina. It would bring communism right into America's backyard.
So the United States at that time, there was a lot of debate in the Johnson administration. What do we do? You know, clearly the Bolivians are being attacked by somebody. We don't have the intelligence to say who's behind the attacks, but clearly they need help. But we don't want to send soldiers into the field because we don't want it to turn into Vietnam. What if soldiers are out on patrol with the Bolivians and they're attacked and American soldiers are dead? You know, we already have Vietnam. We're in the middle of the Cold War. So they were in the middle of this quandary. And at that point, they decided the best thing to do was maybe we should send down the Green Berets to train Bolivians to actually go into the jungles and train the Bolivian soldiers, and they'll do the fighting.
Kevin Maurer is an award-winning journalist and co-author of Hunting Che.
They implemented their strategy by tapping the Green Berets, who were a fairly new force of American soldiers who were focused on doing this kind of counterinsurgency, insurgency operations, and particularly a Major Pappy Shelton, who at the time was a Green Beret with some combat experience in not only in Korea, but also in Vietnam.
Ralph Pappy Shelton was a veteran and career soldier with some experience in special forces missions in Latin America. He flew into Bolivia with just 17 Spanish-speaking Green Berets. Their mission was simple: train the Bolivian soldiers.
The military has a term for training. It's crawl, walk, and run. And when Pappy Shelton and the Green Berets got to Bolivia, the Bolivian army was crawling. And what they had to focus on, what they realized early on, is they had to focus on more than just the military training. They had to focus on hygiene. They had to focus on nutrition. They had to focus on basic physical fitness. And they really had to build this Bolivian military from the bottom up in order to be at the level they needed to take on these guerrillas.
In the meantime, Washington set out to solve their other problem in Bolivia. Their intelligence on the ground was practically non-existent, and they were skeptical the attack had anything to do with Che.
The United States really didn't believe he was there, and if he was there, we didn't believe that he would be on the front lines. Why would he put himself at risk? So there was so much conflicting information, and that built into the whole myth of Che, this boogeyman. And did he have hundreds of men, thousands of men? So the two CIA people that we were going to send down there to gather intelligence couldn't be Americans, because there was always the possibility they could be caught, they could be killed, and you would have an international, you know, public relations nightmare.
And so the CIA decided to call in two foreign agents, Gustavo Viodo and Felix Rodriguez.
I definitely felt the Fidel Castro regime had to go.
Rodriguez was 26, but already a seasoned operative. He had participated in the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba when he was recruited as an exile.
So when I was in Mexico, when I was 17 years old, in 1959, after he took over, and I learned that there was something in Latin America, especially in Dominican Republic, who was called the Anti-Communist Legion of the Caribbean. And there was a recruiting captain by the name of Cortez who was in Mexico, so I volunteered.
Like many Cuban exiles, Rodriguez had a deep dislike of both Guevara and Castro alike. He wasn't taken in by Guevara's charm or revolutionary appeal.
He was a very cruel individual, and very few people doesn't know the real story who Che Guevara was. Really, he was a cold-blooded assassin. And he used to tell me that when Che Guevara joined them in Mexico, he used to ask him, what does it feel when you shoot somebody and see the blood coming out? And he wanted to know what the feeling was. He had an unbelievable desire of killing people. And later on, a lady came to me in a funeral home, and she claimed that her son was 15 years old, and he was picked up putting signs in the walls against Castro. He was supposed to be executed on a Friday. So she asked to see Commander Guevara, and he received her. He said, Senora, what can I do for you? And he said, my son was very young. I will promise he will never do it again. Please save his life. He said, lady, what is the name of your son, and when is he going to be executed? So she gave the name of her son and said, this coming Friday. And his answer was, he called an assistant, and she thought at the time he had saved his son's life. And Che Guevara's answer was, get her son now, execute him now, so she doesn't have to wait until Friday. And she fainted.
Rodriguez and his family were victims of the revolution in Cuba. He and his family were forced to flee when the communists seized power in 1959.
My uncle, who was very close to us, and to me especially, he used to be a minister of public work and also senator in Cuba. So he had to leave the same day to the United States in his boat. When I started looking at the television, what was happening in my country, that's really what decided me to do something about it.
I think it was very personal for Felix. He saw a lot of his friends die. He saw a lot of their businesses confiscated. He saw a lot of good people hurt, and this was his chance to do something good, to bring down someone who he believed was evil.
Hello, Covert listeners. This is your friendly producer, Rachel Jacobs. If you like history shows that talk about the stories that fall through the cracks, then let me recommend Behind the Bastards. It's a podcast from How Stuff Works, hosted by Robert Evans, who you might remember from Crack.com. Every Tuesday, Robert sits down with one of LA's best comedians to talk about somebody from history who is a terrible. The podcast fills in the gaps left by more traditional history education. For example, most of us know that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, but did you know that he wrote erotic novels while he was the dictator of Iraq? Or what about King Leopold II, the first modern bastard? In a more recent episode, Robert talks about how this modern-day Belgian king pioneered the tactic of screwing over tens of millions of people for petty personal gain. So if you're like me and you love hearing great facts about bad people, then check out Behind the Bastards. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In 1967, Rodriguez was summoned to a meeting with the CIA in Miami. His mission would be to advise the Bolivian army in gathering intelligence on the rebel forces. Ultimately, it was to help the Bolivians track Che down. One thing was made very clear to him. His real job was to bring Che Guevara back alive.
The mission itself was, this is a military unit who really doesn't have any experience in guerrilla warfare or intelligence of that type. To make sure that by any chance Che Guevara was captured alive, to make sure that they keep him alive, not to shoot him. And to make sure that they became available to them. And apparently the agency, knowing that, they were very interested in keeping him alive for interrogation.
Rodriguez and Viodo secretly entered Bolivia with the help of the government, under false identities.
They made arrangements so that we could get all the support that we needed to operate in the field. And when we arrived in La Paz, we were taken immediately to President Barrientos' home. And that's where we met with the president. He gave us an ID card, giving us, signed by him as president, telling the military forces and civilian forces to give us all the support that we would require. My name was Felix Ramos Medina.
Soon after, the training began for the largely inexperienced Bolivian army. The Green Berets were not allowed to fight against Che's guerrillas directly for fear of inflaming the situation. And so, for the next 4 months, Pappy Shelton and other veteran soldiers set to work. Mitch Weiss explains that they had their work cut out for them.
Most of them have never even used a gun before. Now we're going to teach them how to use complicated weapons. But what Special Forces does, you know, and the Green Berets do best, is they're able to break down the training into basic chunks where, you know, all the Green Berets are cross-trained. They all speak different languages. And so they went down there kind of like really good teachers. This is how we're going to train them. You know, we're going to spend X number of days on artillery. We're going to spend X number of days on fire, X number of days on the obstacle course. And we're going to build team leadership skills in these guys.
The majority of the 650-man Bolivian 2nd Rangers Battalion were farmers and peasants who had been dragged off the fields and streets and forced to join the army. Even among the few career soldiers, they had very little training.
One of the stories that stuck out with me about the training was it was how little the Bolivian military actually did marksmanship. They shot very few rounds in their normal basic training, but when they started training with the Green Berets, the Rangers, Pappy Shelton was able to secure a lot more ammunition, and they shot their weapons constantly, which was a big change from the way that they previously had been trained. But you know, the logic there is you have to get comfortable firing the weapon. They did that. They did a lot of physical training because a lot of the campesinos didn't have the physical strength that they needed. So they would climb ropes, obstacle courses, and then as they got out of the crawl phase where they were able to use their weapons correctly and patrol correctly, then they got into some walking where they would go out with these patrols at night. But it really ran the gamut from basic, you know, individual soldier skills to team soldier skills to unit soldier skills to the point where they were able to do basic small unit tactics, which were essential to fight the insurgency.
The Green Berets taught them how to march, shoot, move at night, detect booby traps, fight hand to hand, and avoid ambushes. One of the U.S. trainers was Gerald Peterson.
How to treat war wounds, gunshot wounds, shrapnel wounds, basic health. It was like the basic first aid classes that you get in when I went to high school. We organized the aid station for them, and we worked with them in the field. And so when the infantry companies went out to the field, then their medics would go out with them, and then myself and the other medic, a very fine sergeant named James Apka, we'd go out also. We also had a lot of other tasks that we did. We provided support training for the infantry training, for rifle training. The soldiers themselves were, the majority were highly motivated because they liked us. We treated them well.
In the end, though, the training went well. The Bolivian Army became their own unit, known as the Rangers.
Yeah, the Bolivian troops were very responsive to the training, and they actually became a very good fighting unit.
Felix, meanwhile, began his own intelligence training. In Miami, he had been briefed in how guerrilla groups work, including their structures and goals. He was also briefed on the situation in Bolivia and what was known about Guevara's group. These briefings included interrogation transcripts from former Marxist rebels. It was in the dossier of French socialist Regis Debray that Felix became aware of a rebel known by the codename Paco.
I was able to read, I think it was in the report of Debray, that Paco became disaffected with the guerrilla, not because he was not a communist, because he was not a guerrilla. And actually, the way they recruited him, they told Paco that he was going to go to the Soviet Union and Cuba. They never told him he was going to be a guerrilla. So when he left La Paz, thinking that he was going to go to Cuba and the Soviet Union, going through another Latin American country, instead of giving him documentation and a little plane to fly to Paraguay, Uruguay, he was told that he wasn't a guerrilla, he was given a rifle.
From the report, it seemed that Paco was a reluctant fighter for Guevara's cause. If they could find him, they could possibly strike a bargain. Information for his freedom.
In general terms, you know, he knew who Che was, and he liked Che. You know, he respected Che. But he was very disappointed as a guerrilla. He didn't want to be a guerrilla. He wanted to live.
On the ground, Felix began socializing with the local population. He needed to find out what they knew about Che's rebel force, if there were any hints at all.
They were getting reports from the countryside that there were men speaking Spanish, a different kind of Spanish, and they had large sums of money, and they were doling it out, and they were trying to buy a huge amount of supplies.
Felix heard that a group of suspicious men were staying in a remote farm compound, hidden away in the Bolivian jungle. The Bolivian Rangers raided the area, but by the time the army arrived, it was nearly sunset, and the place looked abandoned.
At first, when the Bolivians made a sweep of the property, they found some of the material they left behind, including, you know, pots on the oven that were still had food in them. I mean, that's how quickly they had to flee. But one of the people tells them, look, if you go back there, there are these hidden caves where there's a treasure trove of information about the guerrillas.
Back in the local CIA station in Santa Cruz, Rodriguez was given the documents the Rangers found. It was a wealth of information. Documentation of their contacts in the country, deciphered radio messages from Cuba, and travel information with false names and photographs of the rebels.
One of the things that Felix understood about counterinsurgency is that revolutionaries like to keep journals and make notes. And what he was able to do was exploit these papers.
But the most important of the documents? Che's passport. It revealed how he entered Bolivia disguised as a middle-aged Uruguayan economist in November 1966.
Because the exploitation of intelligence, when you pick it up from a guerrilla camp or a cave or off the body of a dead guerrilla, it can prove hugely valuable because it tells you what their intentions are. And human intelligence, you can always do capabilities from satellites or technical means. But intentions, you really need boots on the ground. And Felix understood that. And he was able to convince the Bolivians that it was a good thing to take evidence, not to burn it.
Also important was Che's diary. Guevara documented his actions daily, his thoughts, his campaigns. He even named names. By reading the diary, Rodriguez found out how and where Che's guerrillas operated, who his colleagues and collaborators were, and could really get inside Che's head. He wrote,
"The morale of the guerrilla movement is growing stronger, and if handled well, will certainly guarantee success."
Che's writings revealed his plans to create a major uprising using the Bolivian peasants. The CIA thought that might have been the case, but as he read on, Rodriguez discovered that Che's strategy wasn't working. The locals were just not interested in joining them. He wrote,
"The peasant base has not yet been developed, although, through planned terror, we can neutralize some of them. Not one enlistment has been obtained."
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that Che made some tactical mistakes very early on. One is he picked the wrong part of the country. They're really two Bolivias. There's the Bolivia that's really active around La Paz, and you have outside of La Paz, tin and copper mines, and you have unions that are there, and you have the university system and students. That would have been ripe for revolution, because in Bolivia, just like much of South America, there was always the conflict between the government and the workers, you know, whether in the mines or in the forest. But Che, for some reason, he picked this area of Bolivia that was remote, that was scrubland. He picked an area where the campesinos, the peasants, the poor farmers, spoke a different language. They really didn't speak Spanish. And so when he came into the area, plus not only did they speak Spanish, but they were very suspicious of outsiders.
He also had no local support from the local people. They didn't care about politics. They cared about gathering enough food today so they wouldn't die before the next day.
The Bolivian Party, the Communist Party, said, you know, we want to work with you, but, you know, help us. You know, let's work together. But Che basically came into Bolivia and said, we're going to do it the Cuban style, the Cuban way. And by doing that, he alienated the Bolivian Communist Party, which could have supplied arms, which could have supplied support, which could have supplied, you know, men. But because he alienated them very early on, they basically divorced themselves from Che's campaign.
Rodriguez realized that Che had wildly miscalculated. His army was small and unfocused.
His message was an empty one, first of all, and they had fear of them.
Then Rodriguez uncovered another clue to Che's operational plans. Among the papers collected was the guerrillas' account books. It showed that all the funds for Che's revolution passed through a single person's hands. But the only lead they had was a single photograph of a woman. Rodriguez realized that if he could track her down, he could cut Che off from all his funds and communication. But who was she? Before he could act on that lead, a critical piece of intelligence reached the Bolivian Rangers. In a remote area of the country, a local farmer had reported that he'd spoken to some guerrillas.
So they went to this farmer called Honorato Rojas, who lived right near the Rio Grande.
The Rio Grande had swollen in some parts due to rainfall. The guerrillas had stopped to ask for guidance from a local.
Because they attempted to contract with a farmer who was going to give them a safe way to cross the river, because at that time, the rivers were swollen, and if you didn't cross the right spot, it would sweep you away. And you really had to be careful about crossing these rivers. So they were using the locals to help.
And now, thanks to the farmer, the Rangers could set a trap for the guerrillas as they crossed.
You know, the currents were flowing, so they needed a safe place to cross, but they also needed a place where they wouldn't be spotted by the Bolivians. Remember, a lot of times they're moving at night because they don't want to be spotted during the day. So the farmer agrees to help them. And he says, I will put a white curtain up at the spot where the coast is clear. It'll be hanging in the breeze, dangling in the breeze. And so they say, fine. And so the plan was, when they saw that white, you know, sheet, that they knew that it would be safe to cross the river and the spot would be safe as well.
Unknown to the rebels, the farmer had told this information to the soldiers as well. During the early hours of the morning, the Rangers stalked out the area surrounding the river. In the meantime, Rodriguez urgently called the Bolivian commander, Colonel Zantano. It was vitally important that any prisoners taken were kept alive.
And what he was able to do by making a great relationship with at that point, Colonel Zantano, was to encourage the Bolivians to engage in counterinsurgency as opposed to just violence. I mean, it had been the Bolivian habit to go and kill guerrillas. Felix understood that you don't get intelligence by killing people. You get intelligence by making them your friends and eliciting information from them. And he was very good at that.
As the afternoon sun dipped below the river, the Rangers could hear some talking in the distance. A lone man appeared between a thicket of grass several meters from the riverbed. It was the farmer, Rojas. Behind the man, several armed rebel fighters appeared and began wading across the water. The farmer waved the men off and walked back towards his village. The rebel fighters continued wading through the river. The Rangers wasted no time. 7 of Che's guerrilla fighters were killed.
As Che's unit was waiting in the river trying to cross because they thought the coast was clear, the Bolivians opened fire. And instantly, their men started falling in the river. They were killed. And the river, which was kind of a muddy color, turned red from their blood. They captured 2 of Che's men.
2 of the men were wounded and quickly captured. One of them was identified as Paco. It was excellent luck. Rodriguez immediately appealed to Zantano.
That's why I interceded and told him that it was very important to us. This prisoner, I even told the general, if you believe that the information we got from him is not worthwhile, I will never ask you for another prisoner. But please give this guy to us. And he did.
One of the major treasure of the ambush was that Paco was captured alive. And Felix went to get him and flew him out. And in the course of flying him out, made this youngster realize that he was not going to be killed. And the relief must have been overwhelming because the other guerrillas were dead. Felix was able to exploit that. And he treated young Paco's wounds and he ministered to him and he elicited information from him.
Felix decided the best tactic for how to handle Paco was to treat him well. Paco was wounded in 2 places, so Felix paid for a private nurse to treat him. While in recovery, Felix would bring him newspapers to read and offered to pass information to his family.
And we developed a good relationship, working relationship. And he was very, very helpful in giving us the complete vision of how the guerrilla operated and all the details of
it. Now, Rodriguez could begin the most important part of his mission, interrogate the person who he thinks could lead him to Che.
I recall Centeno asking him questions and Che looking at him and not saying a word. At one point he was upset and he told, you are a foreigner, you are invading my country. The least you can do is have the courtesy to answer me. And Che would not say a word.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Covert Podcast, on Spotify, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.